Okay, there we go. Good morning, everyone. Our Bible study on Romans. We are going to finish chapter 12 and start chapter 13 today. As you may remember from last week, chapters 12 and 13 are a little bit shorter. They're not short enough for me to cover a whole chapter in 1 week, but they're not long enough that I can split it into two halves. So what I'm doing here is chapters 12 and 13, I'm covering over 3 weeks. So today we're going to finish 12 and start 13. And actually it flows. That's all one topic anyway. So if you remember, chapter 12 begins a new topic. Paul is very linear in the book of Romans, in the letter of Romans. And after he's finished talking about all these topics of justification up through chapter 11, now he's addressing the next logical question, what next? Because of all this, we've learned about our need for justification, what Jesus has done for us, and what God intends. How do we respond? How do we live our lives knowing that we have been justified? So in chapter 12, verse 1, just a little recap, he says, I appeal to you therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. So how do we respond? First of all, why do we respond? He puts it right there, by the mercies of God. Because God is merciful to us and gracious to us, therefore we respond. We got to make sure we get that right, because so many Christians kind of get it mixed up or implied differently that, you know, you should do good works in order to be saved. No, that's not true. We do good works because God has had mercy on us. And what does he say? Present your bodies as a living sacrifice. A little bit of a strange saying there, because a sacrifice by nature is killed or dead. But we are living sacrifices. So we ourselves, your life is a sacrifice to God. And you continue to live your life holy and acceptable, and that is your spiritual worship. And remember, we talked about that phrase. That's not really the best translation. It's really reasonable service. You remember that? And that's even what the footnote says, I think. So how do you serve God? By living an appropriate, God-pleasing life. That's how we say thank you to God for what he's done. And then Paul went into spiritual gifts. This next paragraph here was spiritual gifts, and he gives a list of some of them. It's not exhaustive. There are more. It's not complete. There's a few other spots where there's other spiritual gifts. And perhaps you remember my attitude or my teaching about this is that all of you, at different points in life, depending on where you are in life and the situation you're in, all of you at different points in life have these gifts. At a given point in time, you might have a certain gift. But maybe a year or two later, a different situation arises, your situation changes, your level of faith or knowledge changes, you might have a different gift. So, you know, we can sometimes say it might be a little helpful to do those little spiritual gift surveys. Yeah, those are sort of helpful, I guess. But they do change. And this is not a complete list, of course. Then Paul goes on. We talked about this last week as well. This is where we'll pick up this week, because we kind of cut off in the middle. He says, let love be genuine. Let love be genuine in verse 9. That is a summary of how you live your life, which is what's coming in these two paragraphs, the end of chapter 12. Now, how do you let love be genuine? Real quick, I'm going to zip through this. I don't know if I mentioned this last week, but starting here with the word abhor, and going all the way to the end of verse 13, in the Greek is one sentence. Did I mention that last week?
No.
No, okay. This is all one sentence. That shows us that this is how Paul is explaining to let love be genuine. Be authentic. Be sincere in your love. Be genuine. Can you tell when somebody's not sincere? Usually, unless they're a really, really good actor, right? Yes. How do you let love be genuine? So just to zip through this real quick as a recap, and then we're going to continue on, because that's where we left off. Abhor what is evil, hold fast to what is good. Well, that kind of goes together, right? Shun the things that are bad and stick with the things that are good. And then, in the Greek, that's a comma. These are all commas in here. Love one another with brotherly affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. Have brotherly affection for each other. You may recall, I know I did mention that word is philadelphos. Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love, we should have brotherly love for one another. How ironic, I just saw in a news feed somewhere, like within the past week, that there's been an extreme uptick in crime in Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. And at least for the moment, Philadelphia is the crime capital of the U.S.
Oh my.
The city of brotherly love. Now, you know, something's wrong with that irony right there, right?
Of course.
Anyway, so have brotherly affection for each other like good brothers should, good sisters, good siblings. Outdo one another in showing honor. No, after you. No, after you. No, after you. Comma. Do not be slothful in zeal, be fervent in spirit, serve the Lord. Those three ideas kind of all go together. If you have zeal for something, if you have motivation for something, some ministry, some person to help something or someone, don't be lazy about it. Pursue it. Be energetic about it. Don't be slothful in zeal. Be fervent in spirit. You know, somebody who's just a bubbly spirit, that's a joy to be around, isn't it? All of you have probably been that way at times, and there may be other times where you're a little more subdued or grumpy, right? All of us have that.
Yeah.
Be fervent in spirit, and in those ways you serve the Lord by doing those two things. And then, comma, rejoice in hope, be patient in tribulation, be constant in prayer. This would be a great verse to keep in mind, memorize. Rejoice in hope. We Christians have hope. The world, the non-believing world, does not. We have hope because we know what the end is. We know what the future is. We know what eternity is. And we simply need to persevere with patience through the tribulations of this life because we know the end is great, is awesome, what God has prepared for you. So we have hope. Rejoice in that hope. Because you can rejoice in that hope, what does that mean? It means you can be patient in tribulation, knowing that it will end. The tribulation, the problems that you are faced with, that the devil throws at you, they will end. Be patient in tribulation. And what can help you to be patient in tribulation? Being constant in prayer. Constant in prayer. What a wonderful practical verse right there. Okay? And then he says, contribute to the needs of the saints and seek to show hospitality. Those two ideas go together as well. And then there actually is a period. And then he goes on. So, you know, for a much too long of a recap, does that sound familiar from last week?
Yes.
Any questions? Any thoughts that have bubbled up in the meantime? All right, let's go on. Verse 14. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. Wow. That's a hard thing, isn't it? Bless those who curse you. So, I have this vision in my head of a playground bully picking on somebody who's smaller, weaker, younger, whatever, and you're supposed to bless them. You're supposed to be good to them while they're picking on you. Wow. What about somebody who persecutes you as an adult? Maybe persecutes your ideas, your values. So is that happening today? Oh, you bet. Happens a lot, doesn't it? And we're supposed to respond with kindness, blessing them, bless and do not curse them. I think that's a very difficult thing. And yet this reflects what Jesus taught, doesn't it? What Jesus taught in the Sermon on the Mount. Turn the other cheek. Right. And then Paul continues on in verse 15, rejoice with those who rejoice, weep with those who weep, and live in harmony with one another. So this thought is going to connect to both before and after it. Rejoice with those who rejoice. If somebody's happy, should we be happy with them?
Yes.
Yes. And I think generally Christians do this, but there is a little tendency sometimes in our fallen human nature to be jealous of somebody. Well, look at the good fortune that came upon that person. What about me? Why don't I have that? Why am I struggling with my job, my relationship, my finances, whatever, my health? Look at that person. Why are they? You, no. Set that aside. Just join your fellow brother or sister in Christ and rejoice with them. And then the same token, weep with those who weep. This is one thing that I think Christians and our congregation does exceedingly well. When somebody is grieving because you've just lost a loved one, what do? We comfort and console them. And that's a good thing. We should do that. And I see that all the time because, you know, right now in the past year, I've been doing all the funerals. I see it. And that's a good thing. And Christians should do that and we should continue to do that. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. What is it when you're doing that? What are you doing? You're living in harmony with one another. Live in harmony. The word there actually means, I did look it up, the word there actually means to think the same. To think the same. Think the same with one another. Now, that can be a little hard. Let's see, is everyone in here either married or been married? How often do spouses think the same? Oh, I think we should turn left. No, I think we should turn right. No, I think we should do this. No, I think we should do this. You know, living in harmony with somebody, especially like a spouse, where you're in close connection and living together for many, many, many years, decades. Sometimes living in harmony can be difficult, right? It's an effort. It's an effort. But we should be like-minded. There's a better word, maybe. Be like-minded. So, you know, like I would say, and I'll just give a little bit of a praise, shout out to my wife. She's not here.
Tape that.
Yep, tape that. It's being recorded. I think even though she and I, we disagree on this opinion or that opinion or what to eat or where to go or whatever, that happens, we are like-minded on values. On what we see in life and what we think is a priority in life and what's the most important things in life. We are like-minded in that way. And frankly, that was evident to both of us when we were dating and was key to getting married. That we were like-minded in values and priorities in life. Namely, God and church is a high priority in life.
Right.
So, live in harmony with one another. Now, again, this idea goes not only with before at verse 15, but with the rest of verse 16. How can you live in harmony with one another? Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Never be wise in your own sight. What does it mean to be haughty? That's a word we don't use in modern English anymore.
Think you're better than someone else.
Yeah.
Think you know everything.
You know everything. To be arrogant, to be proud, right? Don't associate, do not be that way yourself. Have you ever been with somebody or been around somebody who is wise in their own sight? See, this idea right here at the end of verse 16.
Oh, yes.
Do not be haughty, do not be wise in your own sight. I can think of two people in my lifetime, not members of the church. I don't even know if they were Christian or not. They were people that I knew from a work environment and from the YMCA that no matter what topic came up, they knew the answer. This is the way it should be, or this is what those people should have done, or this is what the government should have done, or this is what our company should have done, or why didn't our manager do this? And they just were the expert on everything. Well, when you're around such a person after a little while, what do you want to do? You just don't want to be there.
Right.
Oh, really? Okay, so you're the expert on this. And in fact, in one case, the one guy was trying to explain to another guy who was an electrical engineer how to properly wire his house.
Oh, my God.
And I'm like, do you realize who you're talking to? And he's like, well, if you add these two positives together, you change 110 to 220. And I'm like, even I know that's not true. But he was, oh, yes, that's what you do. No. Do not be like that. Do not be haughty. Do not be wise in your own sight. You just drive people away. It harms relationships. It causes disharmony. Instead, associate with the lowly. Now, what does it mean to be lowly?
Humble,
sure. What is the word here? Give yourselves to humble tasks. That's the footnote. Humble. Does lowly mean you're necessarily poor?
No.
No.
Does lowly mean you're necessarily less knowledgeable about something?
No.
No, it doesn't have to do with that either, does it? It really does have to do with humility, just recognizing that you don't know it all, And you can get along with other people and, you know, do things in harmony, right? Lowly. I don't know why it makes me think of this. Again, a word we don't use a lot in English right now. But anybody remember Lowly the Worm?
Yes.
What was the name of those books?
Richard Scarry.
Yeah, Richard Scarry books, right. See, those Richard Scarry books were kind of popular when I was growing up. I had some of those books. I don't even know if they're in print anymore. They were children's books with animal characters, if anybody remembers. And one of the characters was Lowly the Worm. I don't know why that comes to mind for me, associated with Lowly the Worm. So some of you, your teachers, you remember the Richard Scarry books from decades ago. Anyway, so do not be haughty, don't be wise in your own sight. And then verse 17, repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. Again, this is reflecting what Jesus taught, so it's consistent with what Jesus taught. It's in concert with that. Repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to what is honorable in the sight of all. Sometimes when you're stuck in a conundrum and you don't know what to do, there are different options. And some people might say this is an honorable option. Other people might say that's an honorable option. Some people might say this is not an honorable option. Consider how your response appears before people. And do what is honorable. Okay? So, does other people's view of what you do matter?
Yes.
Because you want to uphold what is honorable and godly. I have an example. I sat there at my desk trying to think of an illustration, and I have one, a fairly serious one, that I thought up. And you guys could maybe come up with some other illustrations for me, too. Say there's a young couple. This is not a necessarily hypothetical. I have seen this happen a few times. A young couple has been dating for a while, maybe semi-serious, and a pregnancy happens. So what do you do? There are people out there who would say the honorable thing to do would be have an abortion so that you're not burdened with a baby. After all, it's not a baby yet, they would claim. That's the honorable thing to do. Would we, as Christians, claim that is the honorable thing in the sight of all? No! However, here's the conundrum, because I have been confronted with this before. In that situation, some would say, Christians, good Christians, would say, well, the honorable thing to do is to get married and raise the baby. That is an honorable thing, isn't it? I think we could agree on that. Another honorable thing would be to give up the baby for adoption to a couple that can't have children but wants one. Okay, maybe you can kind of skirt some of those legal fees that make adoption so expensive. So there's two honorable options. Which do you pick? Well, what's honorable in the sight of all? What's honorable in the sight of the church? What's honorable in the sight of God? It is a bit of a conundrum. I don't have a direct answer to it. Because in my mind, had that ever happened to me, well, there's no chance it would have ever happened. But, you know what I mean. But, had that happened to me, first of all, I know some situations where a couple got pregnant, so they decided to do what was an honorable thing, got married, but they hadn't been dating long enough, they didn't know each other, the marriage didn't work, and in a matter of 3 or 4 years later, they got divorced, and now you've got a baby splitting time and going back and forth. If that young couple that has a pregnancy before marriage gets married, and the marriage works, then that is an honorable option. So how do you know? On the other hand, if I were in that situation, and we said, well, the honorable thing, because we just don't know this, that, and the other thing, we're going to give up the baby for adoption. For me, and I would be the father in such a hypothetical situation, I'd be crushed. I'd be like, I want to see my baby. I want to see my son or daughter. Mm-hmm. And yet they're living over there, and maybe I can't have contact. I don't know. So there's some problems there, too. So I'm giving you a hypothetical illustration about how some of these conundrums are difficult. And there are clearly honorable options and dishonorable options. So we have to consider what is honorable in the sight of all. Okay? Now, while I drink some coffee, comments and discussion. I mean, that's a big topic.
In this day and age, there's no agreement as to what is honorable, and so there is no such thing as honorable in the sight of all, I don't think, our society as a whole. I am old enough to remember a time when at least the majority of people, even people who were not religious, who didn't go to church much or even at all, did accept certain moral standards that, you know, and I'm sure there were always a few people who disagreed and were on, but those people were on the fringes and they were not.
Sure.
But nowadays, I don't see how you can, especially in the situation you were mentioning, have something that's honorable in the sight of all, because what is honorable in the sight of Christians so much of the time is...
Sure. I think in the situation that the illustration that I put forward just now, I think in Christian circles we would say, of course, abortion is not an honorable option. But the other two are both honorable options, and so now you have to delve into the details, or if that couple came to me as a pastor, I'd say, well, let's talk. Let's pray about it. Let's talk. What about this? What about that? How would you feel in this case? How would you feel in that case? And you'd have to delve through the details to determine which is the more honorable in that specific case. I'm just using that as one hypothetical, very serious one that obviously we know still happens today, right? Happens all the time.
Bob?
Yeah, Bob's here. How's your dentist appointment?
Very good.
Okay, good.
Positive. Good.
That's rain. I hope you're not saliva from you.
Yeah, Ellen?
Well.
I think now there are a lot of people just like don't care what anyone else thinks.
Yeah.
The money where they actually played the song, I Did It My Way.
Oh, yeah, right. You know, I've heard of that. You know, I Did It My Way. Yes, that's part of the problem with our culture today. People don't care what is honorable in the sight of anyone else. They're going to make a decision based on what I want right now, and that's it. I don't care what anyone else thinks. Well, that's not Paul's advice. Give thought to what is honorable in the sight of all, and of other people too. Okay? Yeah, absolutely. And you're right, many people don't care. Don?
Just a thought on that part that says never be wise in your own sight. Some experience I had was looking at resumes that people submit nowadays. If half of it was true, they'd be terrific, you know.
Yeah, right. You see people with resumes and you wonder how much of it is really true.
Society just, you know, pushes that. You gotta really put it out there.
Right.
You can consider it very good.
All right. Any other thoughts or comments on this point or on my illustration?
Well, it is really difficult to think about honor because I think some people would say cover up, so I still look good.
Right.
There is never going, it's not going to be an honest view of somebody.
Right.
And it's such a struggle, you know. Thankfully, we never had two and four daughters go through a pregnancy before a marriage and what do we do. But I often wondered about it. I don't think I would have encouraged them to get married for the sake of a baby. I would have encouraged maybe adoption instead. But my mind has gone through things too, because when you give a baby up, mothers especially struggle with so much.
Absolutely.
And absolutely. So do sometimes adopted children.
Sure. So there's no easy answer.
There really isn't.
Right.
You've got to seek God and pray.
Right. All right. Let's move on then. Verse 19. So actually, verse 17 here, repay no one evil for evil. That introduces a slightly different thought that relates to how do we live our lives to be honorable, to give thanks to God. But he's going to start expanding upon this right here in verse 19 and into chapter 13. Okay, so this idea of repay no one evil for evil. That's going to be the topic, basically, for the rest of our Bible study today. Because in verse 19 he says, "Never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God, for it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord.'" Should we seek out revenge upon those who have wronged us?
No.
Now that's, again, against our fallen, sinful human nature. We want to get somebody back, don't we? You see it on the playground, you see it in the business world, you see it in family relationships. Somebody wrongs you, insults you, offends you, you want to get them back. We all do. And yet God says, repay no one evil for evil, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay. So, I think part of the problem is, if we truly did trust that God would avenge us, that God would bring justice, I think sometimes we struggle with that. We doubt that. Is God really going to bring justice in my situation that I'm the victim of, or somebody offended me, or somebody wronged me? Is God going to bring justice? If you 100% believe that, that God will bring justice, keep in mind, he will. You may or may not see it, but he will. If you know God will bring justice, you can let it go and move on with your life. What a great place to be in an attitude, right? We need this not for the sake of the other person, the offender. We need this for our sake. Because you can just let it go and say, God, you deal with it. You bring justice however you see. I would like to see it, God. I'd like to see the justice, but if it comes without my awareness, I know you will bring justice to this situation, the wrong that has been inflicted upon me. Okay? So I think a lot of times the fact that we seek justice or want to have justice or strive for revenge ourselves is a sign of weakness of faith that God will bring it. Does it make sense? All right. So this is kind of hard. Verse 20, continuing the same thought. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. For by so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. Now, I have to say, many of you know some of my affinities and likes and dislikes. Maybe in entertainment, some of you know that I do like war movies. I've probably seen every war movie that's out there in the modern era. And one thing, I don't know why I have a fascination with it. I do. Maybe it's, I don't know, the boy in me still. I never served in the military. Part of me wishes I had. I think that's an honorable thing to do. But one thing I can recall seeing is, you know, in various movies, I could cite a few different examples. You know, you're shooting at an enemy. You're maybe fighting hand to hand. And then all of a sudden, the battle is over and this side wins. And what is the inclination of some soldiers? To take revenge on that guy over there who was trying to kill me. However, there are situations in some movies that I have seen, and I'm just kind of thinking, for instance, Saving Private Ryan is one example. The American soldiers defeat the Germans in a given battle, and what do they immediately do with the German soldiers that they've conquered? Yes, there were occasions where they took revenge on them and shouldn't have, but a lot of times they offer them aid. Okay, they need medical attention, they need food or water. You're now my prisoner. I've stopped you from attacking me, so now I will help you. That's this. If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. I don't know how I would react if I were in that extreme situation where you're fighting against somebody. You win the battle, so now you have compassion on your enemy. That's a hard thing, I think, in that type of situation. Yeah, Ellen?
I'm thinking in a situation like that, and probably many others, that could totally change that person's life.
Oh, absolutely.
If someone did that.
Absolutely. It changed both sides. The soldier who's the one giving the aid to the enemy who's been conquered, or the enemy could be expecting, retribution, and it doesn't happen. And I'm not saying it always happened, but I think, you know, at least sometimes in American history, our soldiers were good about that. I think it's because of the Christian moral values that have been embedded in our culture up until now. And so our military generally has tried to do this. As soon as you conquer an enemy and he stops fighting or surrenders, there's a switch. And you start taking care of the enemy soldiers that you are now have as prisoners. Okay? I don't see that elsewhere in history.
During World War II, the Germans were brought over here to work on the farms. And I was a little kid, but I've talked to some of the older people that lived out in our area. And they had the German prisoners here, and they worked in the fields because people here spoke German.
Ah, like in our community, our county, right here?
Oh, yeah. Yes,
really? So, see, I had not heard that before. So there were German prisoners here in our area because we had German people who could speak German. Wow.
And we had them on our farm.
Did you?
Yeah, and I thought one of the remarkable things was because we had a fruit farm, and so, of course, we're producing food for the war effort. So they brought a lot of German, there was prison of war camp up near the airport in Benton Harbor.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow, see, this is all new history to me. I've only been here 12 years, so I didn't know this.
One of the interesting things to me was that we heard, of course, later on about the things that went on in the German prisoner of war camps.
And our soldiers in their camps.
Yes, where they were so badly. And,
right.
And here, they're over here picking fruit.
Yeah, right.
And to come to find out, I don't know what the percentage was, but there's a great number of them wanted to stay here.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, because they're treated so humanely.
Yeah. Right, right.
But that's kind of interesting how different people and different countries and regimes treat one another.
Sure. Don?
After the war, when they were repatriated, a bunch of them came back.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep, that too.
All right. Very good. So, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink, for by so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. What does that mean? Burning coals on his head.
Get it back.
Get it back?
They'll get it one way or another.
I think this is a little saying or a euphemism for bringing shame upon him. Mm-hmm. If you're helping your enemy, then one of two things is going to happen. Either your enemy is going to be ashamed of his behavior and change his ways and stop fighting against you, or he's going to become more resolute in his hardness of heart against you because, oh, okay, I was fighting this guy, now he's trying to help me make himself look good. You become even more hardened of heart, which is going to do what? Bring down God's vengeance even more. Okay? So by being nice to your enemy, you're bringing burning coals upon his head. You're bringing shame upon him. Okay? Because, you know, we were enemies, and yet you're treating me nicely. Shouldn't I be treating you nicely? Yeah. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. So that summarizes these last few verses of this paragraph. Sorry. Questions, comments? So who is it that brings justice to you in the case where you've been wronged? Who brings your justice? Who has vengeance? God. Now how does God do that? See, that's the next logical question. That's chapter 13. How does God bring vengeance on your behalf? Okay, see, all of Romans really is linear and logical. So Paul's going to answer that question next. Right there, you can see from the headings how he's going to do it. So, chapter 13, verse 1, let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. How does God bring vengeance on your behalf? Through the governing authorities. Now, yes, we're going to talk about good governing authorities and bad governing authorities. We will talk about that as we go through this paragraph, okay? But for the moment, assume they're good governing authorities, okay? Be subject to the governing authorities because it's been established by God. I want to read you a quote here from Dr. Middendorf in the commentary. And this is specifically in relationship to this word subject. Subject. Be subject to the authorities. That's a different word than obey. Oh, what's the difference between being subject to and obedience or obey? There's a difference. Okay?
Aren't you putting yourself under?
Yeah, putting yourself under, right? So, here's what Dr. Middendorf says. Paul views all people as subjects to them all, and therefore commands his hearers to be subject to, or perhaps to submit themselves to, these authorities without any qualification. However, the verb be subject to is not one of the verbs typically translated as obey. Therefore, be subject to need not always include responding in complete conformity with what is heard. Neither does it demand total obedience in every instance. Even if non-compliance or direct disobedience to a human authority becomes necessary for a believer, it is to be accompanied by the recognition that one still remains subject to the temporal power of authorities whose response may well involve punishment. So there's a difference between being subject to and being obedient to, and if from time to time you must be disobedient to a governing authority, remember what we hear from Peter in Acts? We must obey God rather than men. So when a governing authority oversteps its bounds or commands or dictates something that is against God, we disobey the governing authority. But in that situation, realize you have just brought about the ire, the wrath, of that governing authority, and you may be subject to what they define as punishment. Okay? So that's Dr. Middendorf's comment on this verse, which it's kind of in concert with what Peter says in Acts. We must obey God rather than men. Should we obey our governing authorities as much as we can? Yes. Are we always subject to our governing authorities? Yes. Even though we don't necessarily obey them in every instance. But realize, when disobedience of an authority comes into play, you may be subject to punishment. So, if the government ever required me, if someone in the government or any authority ever required me to preach a certain way about the definition of marriage, I would absolutely disobey and continue the way I am, preaching and teaching God's word, knowing that there's a fair chance they will punish me by jailing me. Okay? I foresee that day coming. Not necessarily for me personally, but maybe for the pastor after me or the pastor after him. But that day is probably coming. So disobedience may be necessary, but realize you'll be subject to punishment. Okay, thoughts, comments?
Maybe I shouldn't bring this up. I'm going to anyway. How does this read? I was immediately thinking of what Paul says in Ephesians 5 about wives being subject to their husbands.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can remember a time when, in fact, it was probably that way when Bill and I got married, when the marriage vows, the wife would say the same things, promise the same things as the husband did, except she would also promise to obey.
Mm-hmm.
But obey is a little different from being subject to.
It is.
Now, which is it in marriage?
Well, we still have that option in the marriage vows. And I talk to young couples when I do a wedding, and I say, now here's the old-fashioned ones, and here's how it relates to what Paul says in Ephesians. And you might be surprised, or maybe not, but most young couples that I've done weddings for pick the old one, where the wife says, promise to obey the husband. So, for whatever that means, that's in there. Now, yes, if a husband were to tell his wife, we're not going to church. Well, there's a cause for disobedience, isn't there? Yeah, I'm going to church. And that's what, and I'm taking the kids. And I want you to come with me, and I'll pray with you and for you, but I'm going to church. So, yeah, actually, there is a little bit of this might interact with the marriage situation, two husbands and wives. But that's really not what Paul intends here. He's talking about governing authorities. Okay? All right. Yeah, I could go on. We should, you know, if we wanted to delve on the whole husband and wife situation and marriage, we should jump into Ephesians. You're right. We'll get it there.
Right.
That's a whole other topic.
And we did do that in this class.
And we have done that. Yes, we have done that. Right.
I know.
Any other questions or comments here? Anne, you look like you want to say something.
Well, right now it's just it's really hard to be subject to.
It is.
Some of our government.
Well, let's say there were a government official. Oh, let's say a governor or a president who you disagreed with, but must you still respect and honor the position?
Yes.
Yeah.
You must. We are subject to. Even though you might not want to, even though you might not like policies or things that they're promoting, yet, we're going to get to that, you still must respect and honor the position. That can be a hard thing for anybody, but especially Christians, when there is a leader who is at the head of authority that you don't respect. You don't want to honor. But yet we need to respect and honor. Yeah, that's a hard thing. I agree. You know, somebody last night, see, I'm jumping to the end here. Maybe I should leave this till the end. I'll just briefly mention it. Did Jesus do that? Was he subject to a corrupt authority?
Yes.
Multiple corrupt authorities, corrupt Jewish authorities, corrupt Roman authorities. Did he submit to them? Did he subject himself to them? Yes. Did he still respect and honor the authorities?
Yes.
Pilate? Yeah, he did. With the Jewish leaders? Yeah, he did. More on that when we get to the end. Okay?
But he was not afraid to disagree with them.
He was not afraid to disagree.
When he knew they were...
That's right. But he still was subject to them. So how do we do that in our lives? It's a very difficult thing. Very difficult thing. Okay, one more comment on this verse before we go on. I want to read for you another quote. This is from Dr. Martin Franzman. What a great name.
Oh, yeah.
But for the first one.
Yeah, that's it. So Dr. Franzman, he was a seminary professor back in the middle of the last century at St. Louis. He has a quote about this verse, chapter 13, verse 1. Franzman captures the emphasis in the original as follows. One could reproduce this feature of Paul's Greek in bad English somewhat as follows. Be subordinated to the authorities that exist, that have been ordained by God. He who refuses to subordinate himself is resisting God's ordinance. Therefore, one must subordinate himself. The word here, being subject to, and the other words also down here as well, the word there is ordained. Has God ordained our governing authorities? Yes. So the Greek word actually would be not subordinated, ordinated, but subordained. We are subordained underneath the authorities that God has ordained. Okay?
How do we go about this when they are going above and beyond their real authority and their...
Good question. So what happens when you have a corrupt authority and they're not following what they should be doing? Who brings about vengeance?
God
does. We pray and trust in God to bring about vengeance and to make things right. Same thing applies to our governing authorities, just like applies to us individually. In the end of the last chapter, vengeance is mine, says the Lord. So, perfect example. At the time in the Old Testament, when the Israelite leadership, actually for both the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah, they both had multiple strings of bad kings. Kings who were not faithful believers, kings who were promoting worship of the Baals, corrupt authorities. People couldn't really do much about it. But those who were honorable, or, you know, faithful at that time, would pray to God, and God fixed this situation. What did God do to avenge the people against those corrupt Jewish authorities at that point in time? He used another authority to come in and punish those authorities, namely the Babylonians. the Babylonians came in and wiped out the Jewish authority and took the people into exile. Yes, the people were subject, unfortunately, to the punishment due to their bad leadership. God brought the Babylonians in, another governing authority, earthly authority, to punish this earthly authority. But the Babylonians were not faithful people. They didn't believe in God, most of them. Some of them did. Few of them did. Think of the wise men. But most of them did not. So God now had to punish the Babylonians. How did God punish the Babylonians? The Persians! Exactly! The Babylonians were conquered by the Persians. And the Persian king, Cyrus, he was a more gracious king. In fact, there's some hints, maybe he had some belief in the true God. We don't know. But he let the Jews go back home and rebuild their homeland. So how does God take care of corrupt authorities? By bringing other authorities to discipline them. And we can kind of see that in our own government a little bit. Where, you know, if the Justice Department is acting properly, they can, you know, an auditor general in a certain area of bureaucracy can come across and, you know, prosecute and try and straighten things out. That's really what we should pray for. That the appropriate levels of that justice would come about through God's manipulation within the channels of the governing authorities. Okay? And then also, you would say in our particular situation, the ultimate source of authority for our government is really where? We the people. Which is kind of unique in world history. So we can change the governing authorities. If we get enough people to understand the truth, you can vote and say, that's not what we want. You're not being a faithful governing authority. So we're kicking you out and replacing you with this over here. We struggle with that constantly in America. And hence, that would be an avenue for God to bring about vengeance. But we individually, should we act as mercenaries? No. Should we act single-handedly to try and topple some authority? No. We leave it up to God. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. Okay? All right. Some pretty significant issues, especially in light of current events in America. Does that help answer it?
Yeah, is it all right to pray for God to hurry up?
Yes, absolutely. And you can say, I would say, you can pray and say, well, this leader or that leader, I think, is, you know, not acting in a godly manner. Their policies are not in a godly manner. God, please replace them. Please make things happen so that this person is... Yeah, you can pray for that. That God would bring about justice. There you go. Just pray that God would bring about justice. So whatever God knows to be just, he will make it happen. Okay? And in the meantime, we have to wait.
Yeah.
We have to wait. That's hard. Yeah. All right. So continuing this thought, boy, that we spent a lot of time on verse 1 there, didn't we?
Yeah.
We can kind of zip through a lot of the rest of this, so give me a little bit more time. I know we're at 10:30 here, but... Alright, verse 2. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. When you have no fear of the one who is in authority, then do what is good, and you will receive his approval. For he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. Okay, right here, two concepts. First of all, the concept of what is the purpose of the government according to God. The purpose of the government according to God, according through Paul, is to promote the good. Where does he say that? Rulers are not a terror to good conduct. Would you have no fear, then do what is good and you will receive his approval. The purpose, one purpose of the government is to promote good, and the second purpose of the government is to punish the wrongdoer. Okay? Punish the wrongdoer. Those are the two God-given purposes of government. Now, if the government does not do those purposes, then we would say it's not a godly government, and we should pray that it would be changed, toppled, you know, removed, or replaced, or whatever. Yes. Now, notice what's not in there. social programs. Now, here's a word that some of you might be familiar with, adiaphora. It means neither commanded nor forbidden. And throughout most of world history, governments were not involved in social programs, helping the poor, helping the sick, etc., the destitute. Governments were not involved in that. Who did that job?
Churches.
Churches, exactly. In fact, the early Christians, in the time of the early church, in the centuries right after Jesus, were known for that. Because the common attitude among the populace was, well, they're poor, they're not worth it, I'm not going to bother with them. Or they're sick, well, then maybe they should just deserve to die, I'm not going to bother with it. And yet Christians had compassion for the poor, the sick, the downtrodden, and would help them. And Christians became known for that. And that was actually part of the spark of growing the Christian church, even in the midst of persecution in the early Christian church. Okay? And you think about in American history, does our Constitution speak to social programs?
No.
So can the government do it? The government can do it, but it doesn't have to do it. Both according to God and according to our own Constitution. Now, it's a good news, bad news situation that our government has gotten involved in this. Okay? This is me speaking personally, not on behalf of the doctrine of the Lutheran Church, okay? So don't hold me this against me. It's just my opinion. Back probably around the time of World War II, some social programs started to be developed within the U.S. government. And then they were expanded even more, maybe in the 60s. Okay? So all these social programs came about. I think it's a good news, bad news situation. Because first of all, the government has a farther reach to help people who are in need of help than the church does. Okay? It shouldn't be that way, but it is. So the government could help more people than the church could help. That's the good news situation. But as the government in the last century became more and more involved in welfare programs and social programs and helping people, what happened on the church side?
Went down.
The church became less concerned about helping people who needed help. And I think that's true in the Lutheran Church as well, by the way. So it's a good news, bad news situation. Should our government be helping poor people? Well, we might say yes. We are founded on Christian principles. But should the church really be the primary source of help for those who are downtrodden? Yes. I don't have an answer. I'm just giving you my observation. That's all. It's not part of the government's responsibility to help poor people. That's part of the church's responsibility. And we should be doing that more than we are. So those two of you who just came in from the soup kitchen, kudos to you.
Yeah.
Helping people who need help. Very good. Yes. And so we do what we can in the little areas where we can. All right. Yeah, Ann?
And part of the problem of that is when the government decides, especially Catholic charities in the United States, have really been hit by government policies when it comes to gay couples can't adopt.
And, right.
So there have been good things that have been taken away.
Yeah.
Because the government has said, oh, you have to adhere to what we believe.
Right.
And what we are dictating to you.
Right.
And that is the sad thing.
Yeah, and that, so the government has an overreach, you know, taking care of poor people or welfare programs. Okay, that's not necessarily a bad thing. But then they actually directly fight against some of the church's efforts.
Yeah.
And that's a problem. Yeah, totally agree, that's a problem.
And the government always seems to cost more for them to do anything.
Yeah, by necessity, the government has more bureaucracy and more paperwork and more administrators, and so actually less of the dollars get to the help where they need to be helped rather than through the church where we don't have that. Well, at least in the Lutheran Church. Catholic Church has some bureaucracy. No, I don't want to badmouth them. They do a lot of good charities. So, all right. Other comments or questions or observations? All right, so those are the two purposes of the government that Paul defines here, and it's elsewhere as well. The government promotes the good and punishes the wrongdoer. Now, this caused a little bit of a conundrum for some Lutherans back in the time of Martin Luther, because they wondered if it was a godly profession to serve as a soldier or a law enforcement officer, because God says, vengeance is mine. Why am I doing this? Well, I would say to them, and Luther wrote a pamphlet specifically, I think it was titled On Being a Soldier, and he said, yes, if you're serving in government as a Christian, whether it's a soldier, a law enforcement officer, a judge, a magistrate, a bureaucrat or administrator, you are acting as a minister of God in that realm of society. So this is the beginning also, this is the second point I wanted to make about these few verses here. This is one of the places for the foundation of Luther's doctrine of the two kingdoms. You guys have heard about the two kingdoms doctrine, right? It's one of our Lutheran things that we talk about. There's the kingdom of the right and the kingdom of the left. The kingdom of the right is the church. And what should the church be involved in? Spiritual matters, eternal matters, teaching and preaching about Jesus, delivering the forgiveness of sins, strengthening people in faith, ministering to their needs. The left-hand kingdom is the kingdom of the government. And what's the area the government should be involved in? Keeping peace and order. Promoting good and punishing bad. That should be the government's side. Now, this was unique for Luther to say this, because prior to him, the two were mixed. Going all the way back even into the Old Testament times, the two were mixed. And at the time of Luther, the Pope was involved in secular matters, and the Holy Roman Emperor was trying to dictate to the church what it should and shouldn't do. So they were mixed together, and Luther said, no, you need to stay in your own camps. You know, over here, you do that, and you stay over here and do that. This came about in the American Revolution, too. Thomas Jefferson coined the term the separation of
church
and state. Actually, Lutherans at that time said, yeah, we already teach that. Two kingdoms. We believe in that. And there's only one little sliver where the church and state should cross in our eyes. And I've mentioned it just recently. I would say three things that the government would say are political and they have the right to say on them. And we would say, no, they're theological. We have the right to talk about them. And those three things, I would say, are religious freedom. We should have the right to worship and gather and do what we want and preach what we want. Second one is abortion, and then the third one is the definition of marriage. All three of those, we can point to the Bible and say, this is what God says. So we would say in the church that those are theological issues that the church speaks to. All three of those, the government would claim in our modern day America that they have the right to speak to those issues because they're political issues. But otherwise, outside of that, we do believe in the separation of church and state. You know, if you believe in higher taxes or lower taxes, you believe in this program or that program, you believe in more immigration or less immigration or building a wall on the border or not building a wall on the border, the church doesn't speak to that because we shouldn't. And you won't hear us talk about that from the pulpit or in the Bible study. I have my own private personal opinions. But I don't speak about those because it's not appropriate. The church speaks to forgiveness and Jesus and faith. Those types of issues. You see that? So it's the separation of church and state, or as we would say, the doctrine of two kingdoms. Now, yes, I have my own personal opinions on taxes. I don't like them and I don't want them. But I don't preach that from the pulpit, right? Okay, I should have whispered that or told you. Don't tell anybody my opinion on taxes. All right, we're all the way back to the verse 5. Any questions or comments? Okay, let's finish up this paragraph, and that's where we'll end. Therefore, one must be in subjection, not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience. He's kind of reiterating here, verse 5. He's reiterating what Paul has already said. If you want to avoid God's wrath, and you want to avoid the wrath of the government, you need to be subject to them, subordained underneath them, submit to them, even though that doesn't necessarily mean total obedience. Also, for the sake of conscience, do you want to be part of the government promoting what is good? Then do what is good. That's what he said up higher. You know, do what is good. They're not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. That gives you a clean conscience. Okay? So verse 5 is really kind of reiterating what he said up higher. Then in verse 6, for because of this you also pay taxes. For the authorities are ministers of God, attending to this very thing. Pay to all what is owed to them, taxes to whom taxes are owed, revenue to whom revenue is owed, respect to whom respect is owed, honor to whom honor is owed. So, you have to pay taxes. I don't want to. I want them as small as possible. Did Jesus pay taxes?
Yes.
Yeah, he did. So do we have to pay taxes? We can argue about how much it should be and what it should be spent for, but yes, you have to pay taxes. For the authorities are what? Ministers. Wow. See, this directly relates to our Lutheran understanding of two kingdoms. God values the left-hand kingdom of secular government just as much as the right-hand kingdom, probably not. The right-hand kingdom is more valuable, I think. But the left-hand kingdom of the government is still important because it brings peace and order, structure to society. If we lived in a society of chaos and anarchy, you couldn't function. None of us could. So they are still ministers of God. So you have to pay taxes. Pay to all what is owed to them. Taxes to whom taxes, revenue, respect, and honor. Now, these four items here, taxes, revenue, respect, and honor, really are in view of the government. Different governmental entities you pay different things to. So you pay taxes to the federal government and the state government. Maybe to the state you pay revenue in the form of sales tax. A portion of your revenue, if you're a small business, goes to the state to cover sales tax. So that would be a different avenue, a different entity. Are there other governmental entities to whom you must give respect or honor? Yes. A policeman shows up at your door. Maybe because you called him or you need some help, or maybe because he's investigating something that happened next door or whatever. Some people are very disrespectful to the police, are they not?
Oh, yes.
And that's been growing lately in our society, which is a really sad thing.
Yeah.
You don't pay taxes directly to the policeman. You don't pay revenue directly to the policeman. He's paid through taxes, but not directly from you. But you do owe him respect. You do owe him respect, whether you believe or agree with what the police are doing or their function or not. And sadly, you know, that's been growing in the past year or so, people that have been disrespecting the police. That's not what God would want. What about honor? You know, when you're in a courtroom, for whatever reason, what do you do when the judge comes in?
Stand up.
Yes, you honor the judge. You're not paying him directly. He's paid through other channels and whatever, but you still owe him honor, whether you agree with what judges are doing or not. And there are some bad judges, yes, but you still must honor them. Okay? Now, again, just one more little thought from me, and then we'll have some brief discussion, and then we're done. While these four items, I think, are in view of governmental entities, authorities, I think this applies in all areas of life, too. So this is just me talking. Mm-hmm. Should you respect your neighbor?
Yes.
Should you honor your parents?
Yes.
Should you honor those who are around you in other authorities, you know, your boss if you're employed, or respect, community members? Should we respect and honor one of them? Yeah, I think this applies in other areas of life. Okay? All right. Very good. I think that covered everything on my notes, and we're over time. Any questions or comments? So time for a minute or two for some comments or questions. All right, this was your lesson all about government. It's like a social studies class, right? Mixed with religion. All right, no questions? Everybody's ready to go. You want to get out there in that rain, right? All right, let's rise and close with the Lord's Prayer.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us.
is the kingdom, we just prayed. Yes. It's all God's, yes. Right? Yes. All right, have a good day, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Thank you.